The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Last show of the week. Hard to believe. Friday is already here. Here at Edstone, we're receiving some much-needed rain, a slow, steady drizzle all morning to bring back some of the color in the grass that's actually turning brown here. And not just because of the 2 weeks of activity with the recent youth camp, but because it has been warm and sunny for a number of weeks. So we're certainly enjoying the rain. As I was telling my class this morning, it's hard to believe that in moving over here 19 months ago, I'd ever find myself in a position where I was in England praying for rain. But that's what I've been doing on and off here over the last 2 or 3 weeks. So it's here, and we need it. If you'd like to email the show, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Coming up later in the program, if we have time, I'll try to close the loop on the subject we got into yesterday with becoming a more cultured individual. There is quite a lot, though, here at the outset that I'd like to get to. 2 weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal reported that $400 million payment that America made back in January, I guess January the 17th, the journal reported that U.S. Officials had acknowledged that they wouldn't allow the plane from Iran Air. I think it was situated there in Geneva. It was loaded with pallets of cash, but it wouldn't let this plane take off until the plane that was in Iran left with those hostages and had its wheels up, as these officials brought out. That was a couple of weeks ago, that report in the Wall Street Journal, and President Obama came out right away and immediately dismissed this story. That was on August the 4th, when he said that the United States does not pay ransom for hostages. This is clip one.
Instead, what we have is the manufacturing of outrage in a story that we disclosed in January.
That's what he said August 4th. Secretary of State, or former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton said similar things, that, well, this is an old story. We announced that this cash was given over in January, and that it was part of a long dispute over payments that were lifted because of the sanctions being lifted in January. But notice what the president went on to say, clip two.
We do not pay ransom for hostages. But those families know that we have a policy that we don't pay ransom. And the notion that we would somehow start now in this high-profile way and announce it to the world, even as we're looking into the faces of other hostage families whose loved ones are being held hostage, and say to them that we don't pay ransom, defies logic.
And the White House spokesman said something similar to that. Here's how Secretary of State John Kerry chimed in.
The United States of America does not pay ransom and does not negotiate ransoms with any country. We never have, and we're not doing that now. It's not our policy.
So that's what the whole administration was saying 2 weeks ago. And now, as of yesterday, we come to find out that the $400 million was, in fact, exchanged as ransom for those prisoners. Certainly, it was held until those prisoners were released. The money was not going to be leaving Geneva. The two were definitely linked together. And the State Department spokesman, John Kirby, admitted as much yesterday.
In basic English, you're saying that you wouldn't give them the $400 million in cash until the prisoners were released, correct?
That's correct.
That's correct. You wouldn't give them the $400 million until the prisoners were released. Now, just 2 weeks ago, the AP headline said State Department calls report linking payment to Iranian prisoner release false, quote unquote, false. That was the headline just 2 weeks ago. This report from the Journal linking payment to the Iranian prisoner release, that is false. And then yesterday, there's Mr. Kirby saying, well, that's correct. I mean, we did hold on to it until the prisoners were released, and then we gave them the money. The Wall Street Journal more recently, this is in yesterday's edition, it says here, after everyone in the administration from President Obama on down denied that a $400 million cash payment to Iran had anything to do with the same-day release of four American hostages, the State Department on Thursday said, your own eyes had it right the first time. Yes, what you saw, what you believed, what you sensed from the beginning, you had it right. You had it right. Now, the Journal also noted that since this linkage from January 17th, what has Iran done since the nuke deal on January 16th? What has Iran done? Well, it's taken three more Americans hostage. It's demanding more money, $2 billion, taking the United States to court. This is what the Wall Street Journal also had to say yesterday in a separate piece. The picture emerged, just going back over some of the latest revelations, the picture emerged from accounts of U.S. officials and others briefed on the operation. U.S. officials wouldn't let Iranians take control of the money until a Swiss Air Force plane carrying three freed Americans departed from Tehran on January 17th. Once that happened, an Iranian cargo plane was allowed to bring the cash home from Geneva, a Geneva airport, that day. Later on in the article, it says the use of an Iranian cargo plane to move pallets filled with $400 million brings clarity to one of the mysteries surrounding the cash delivery to Iran, first reported by the Wall Street Journal this month. Administration officials have refused to publicly disclose how and when the transfer took place. They kept all of this secret. They covered all of this up. They did announce that the money had been given to them, but they kept it secret how and when everything was transferred. Loaded with these pallets of money, it says, euros, Swiss francs, and so on. But it wasn't just but a few days ago, it seems, I guess 2 weeks now, where the president was saying that, well, this isn't anything nefarious. Don't worry.
This wasn't some nefarious deal.
It wasn't nefarious at all. We've been, as he said at the start of his presidency, we've been completely transparent. But now we see, like with so many other details revolving just about anything with Iran, there were things that were covered up from the very beginning. I mean, this is just the cash payment. If you recall, back in January when we talked about those sailors being kidnapped or detained, from the very beginning, it was almost laughable to see U.S. officials rush to the microphone saying, hey, there's nothing to be concerned about here. This was just two friends helping each other out, or one friend helping another out in distress. That's the way they portrayed those sailors being captured and held at gunpoint. This is what Secretary of State John Kerry said back in January.
I want to underscore how pleased I am that our sailors were safely returned into United States hands this morning. I also want to thank the Iranian authorities for their cooperation and quick response. These are always situations which, as everybody here knows, have an ability, if not properly guided, to get out of control. And I'm appreciative for the quick and appropriate response of the Iranian authorities. All indications suggest or tell us that our sailors were well taken care of, provided with blankets and food, and assisted with their return to the fleet earlier today. And I think we can all imagine how a similar situation might have played out 3 or 4 years ago. And in fact, it is clear that today this kind of issue was able to be peacefully resolved and efficiently resolved, and that is a testament to the critical role that diplomacy plays in keeping our country safe, secure, and strong.
So they were saying that it was just nothing more than, well, they helped us out, they released them quickly, and really this is just a sign of how successful all of these diplomatic efforts have been. They were breaking their arms, basically patting themselves on the back. Josh Earnest came out later and said, you know, we really have to draw attention to Secretary Kerry's efforts here. Well, his efforts and how they played an important role in securing this outcome. Earnest said, I do think it underscores the value of the diplomatic line of communication that's been opened between Secretary Kerry and his counterpart. I mean, we're both friends now. And so we have these sailors in distress, and they're picked up by the Iranians, and, well, we can be thankful that it was the Iranians and that we're now friends because they let them go, and they were so cooperative. And then this statement here, this one really takes the cake. This is from Vice President Joe Biden just a day or two after the sailors were detained, January 13th.
What happened was, apparently, we had, from our military, one of the boats had engine failure, drifted into Iranian waters. The Iranians picked up both boats, as we have picked up Iranian boats where that needed to be rescued, and took them to, I'm not sure exactly where, I don't want to misspeak here, mm-hmm. and realized they were there in distress, and said they would release them, like, you know, ordinary nations would do. That's the way nations should deal with. That's why it's important to have channels open.
Did we apologize to the Iranians?
No, there's no apology. Nothing to apologize for. When you have a problem with the boat, you apologize the boat had a problem? No. And there was no looking for any apology. Okay. This was just standard nautical practice.
This is just what ordinary nations do. We're an ordinary nation. Iran's an ordinary nation. No apology. And then, of course, about a day later, out comes this public, this apology that made the United States look, well, it was a shameful display put on by one of the sailors, who was made to apologize on camera. This is what he said.
What matter that you penetrated in Iran territorial water?
It was a mistake. That was our fault. And we apologize for our mistake.
And we apologize. It's all our fault. It's our mistake. And yet before that apology, there were U.S. officials assuring us that, well, there was no apology given, and this was nothing out of the ordinary. It was a Navy vessel that had some engine trouble, and as it turns out, the Iranians helped us. Well, now we have the veil lifted on all the details, including the fact that $400 million was held up on the runway in Geneva to make sure that the Iranians let those last hostages go. It's pretty amazing. Just the whole, as I say, everything that revolves around Iran, you can pretty much be sure that it's going to be covered in a veil of secrecy to begin with, and then spun a very definite way that fits in with the administration's agenda. And then when the facts start to emerge that contradict the way that it was spun, there's the endless repeated denials. And then finally, when it's not anything you can deny plausibly, then you just resort to the fact that, well, it's an old story. That's what Secretary of State Clinton had to say here recently. I thought this was interesting, too, because it's happening, and again, we touched on this at the time, back in January, but this is what President Obama had to say in his State of the Union address on January 12th.
The United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth. Period. Period. It's not even close. It's not even close. It's not even close. We spend more on our military than the next eight nations combined. Our troops are the finest fighting force in the history of the world. No nation attacks us directly or our allies because they know that's the path to ruin.
No nation attacks us because they know that's the path to ruin. A couple of hours before he made that statement, the Iranians seized two U.S. Navy patrol boats in the Persian Gulf. Now, as that was going on, as that drama was playing out on January 12th, we learned even a day or two after that from Reuters that the U.S. government had initially hoped to keep it under wraps, to even keep it covered. The fact that it had happened because, well, President Obama was going before the nation that night, January the 12th, to say that we're the most powerful nation on earth. No nation dares attack us. Nobody's going to attack us because they know that's the path to ruin. Is that what they know? Is that what nations think now when they think of the United States? Well, look at how it played out. Look at how it continues to unfold. This was something that was covered up from the beginning. All the facts. And it doesn't matter which spokesman it was. The White House spokesman, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, the president himself. One lie after another lie after another lie. And now, well, everybody's on vacation. The president's on vacation. Congress is out of session. And the media, you think the media is going to hold anyone accountable for this web of deceit? Nothing nefarious about this deal? Nothing? Remember the Ben Rhodes affair back in May? The New York Times Magazine revelation? That this guy's basically a fiction writer. A 38-year-old. The boy wonder, as he's called. And one of the most influential foreign policy gurus in the White House. This article from the New York Times magazine. Rhodes' innovative campaign to sell the Iran deal is likely to be a model for how future administrations explain foreign policy to Congress and to the public. The way in which most Americans have heard the story of the Iran deal presented, that the Obama administration began seriously engaging with Iranian officials in 2013 in order to take advantage of a new political reality in Iran, which came about because of elections that brought moderates in power or to power in that country, was largely manufactured for the purpose of selling the deal. It goes on and says that the particulars of the story, that was the story to sell the deal, to get the nuke deal through. The particulars were often misleading or false. That's the New York Times story. That's the New York Times account. And then basically it quotes Ben Rhodes later in the piece to paraphrase. He's basically gloating over the fact that, oh yeah, we had our critics just all twisted up in knots. They didn't know what to do. They were furious. We played them. There he was bragging about how easy it was to lie about the whole deal from beginning to end. That was the nuke deal that happened right at the same time as those sailors were kidnapped. There were other hostages around that same time. I mean, I get some of those details confused myself. So much was covered up. Right there in the middle part of January. To the point where even now, here we are, 8 months later, and some of the lies are still being exposed. This wasn't some nefarious deal. It wasn't. Nothing nefarious about this deal. You put the revelations of yesterday together with what Ben Rhodes said in May, together with what Reuters reported in January, with what the president said on the day those sailors were kidnapped. Nothing nefarious. I refer again to my father's piece, America's Real Enemy. That was in a recent Trumpet magazine. It's now part of a new booklet available online at thetrumpet.com. Great again. Search for it. This article, though, America's Real Enemy, my father says, never has a president and his staff been so brazen and deliberate in using deceit. It's quite a statement. But we're finding more and more evidence to how accurate that statement is with each passing day. Never has a president and his staff been so brazen and deliberate in using deceit. Mr. Obama repeatedly said how transparent his administration would be, yet virtually everything he has done has been in the dark. My father says that is the path to a violent dictator ruling America. I read that part just the other day. That's the path to a violent dictator ruling America. And it wouldn't take but a few large and destructive riots to reach that nightmare. We've got to keep our eyes open to what's happening in America these next several months. Because its many freedoms are eroding away. And we're seeing more and more abuses of power at the very top. And a very deceitful administration through and through. My father wrote, as these scandals pile higher and higher, nobody can get administration officials to tell them anything. They've lied and lied and lied, and then they've been caught in their lies. This administration covers itself in a cloak of deceit. In some cases, they have even joked or bragged about their lies. That's what Ben Rhodes did in May. They brag about it. Well, this is just what we do. And the New York Times Review or the New York Times Magazine says, well, people are going to start looking back at what Ben Rhodes did to sell this deal and think, well, this is the model for how future administrations explain foreign policy. The shame on the New York Times. Instead of being appalled, look at what's happening to our government institutions. It's viewing this as if it sets a good precedent for the years and administrations ahead. What does it say about our society? My father says it's impossible to measure the damage that such deception has wreaked on the fabric of our politics and our society. It's impossible to measure. But then he goes on and makes the comment that no one seems to care. As I say, I mean, the president's still on vacation with his family. Even as California burns and Louisiana is drowning in massive flooding, the press, you can be sure, would hold a Republican to account, even for those disasters, certainly for not being there when they're happening. But you can be sure there's not going to be any accountability here to speak of. It's old news. It's an old story. I mean, hey, this revelation came out in January, don't you know? That's the conventional wisdom in the left-wing press. Revelation 12 and verse 12. Satan's been cast down. He knows his time is short. He's deceived the whole world. Paul called him the God of this world. Paul said he's blinded the minds of them which believe not. In 2 Corinthians 6, Paul wrote about how easy it is to be beguiled by the subtlety of the devil. Because Satan, well, in that same chapter, it says he presents himself as an angel of light. An angel of light. See, a president can come out and say, come on, you guys, you're just manufacturing outrage here. There's nothing nefarious about this deal. We told you about it months ago. It's an old story. Let's move on. and a couple of reporters at the Journal, to their credit, they stay on the story. And they reveal something explosive yesterday. Well, at least the State Department did itself, confirming what the Journal reported. Who will be held to account? Well, we've seen this happen before, have we not? We certainly have. The devil's fingerprints, this is from my father's article. The devil's fingerprints are all over what's happening in America today. He's the father of lies, you see, John 8:44. Of course he's behind it. It's not just one man or one administration. There's a spirit world here that we've got to be cognizant of. His fingerprints, Satan's fingerprints, are all over this. My father said the contempt for law springs from Satan's own lawlessness. The support for America's enemies, the appeasement of dictators, the undermining of alliances, the hatred of the Jewish state, all of these are telling signs of Satan's influence. That's the source. That's the source for this evil. He's full of wrath. Revelation 12 says he and his demons are confined to this earth. And that's why, whether you're looking at what's happening in America or in the Middle East or in Europe or in Russia, Russia's pushing up tens of thousands of troops at Ukraine's border. Who's behind that? What spirit is behind that? It's a stark contrast. Again, when you just go back a little ways in our own history, America's history. Over the last couple of months, I've played for you a few quotes or clips from President Reagan, his presidency during the 1980s, and mostly I've just focused in on his repeated acknowledgement of the great Creator God. And the need for a moral awakening in the United States, and for us to be a people of prayer and submission to God. Well, let me just play you one snippet from, this is Reagan after he wins the election in 1980. He comes into office. I believe the inaugural address was maybe January the 20th, if memory serves me right, from 1981. And this is an exchange he had with a reporter, Sam Donaldson, during his first press conference. He's barely 10 days into office when Sam Donaldson asks him about, the Cold War and the Soviet Union's aggressions. The Soviet Union had been on a rampage during the late 1970s, during the Carter administration. Just taking over one little nation after another, one territory after another. And then along comes Reagan. And, well, you know the history with the Iranian hostage crisis then. They let the hostages go, finally. And then this is the exchange that the president had with a reporter regarding the Soviet Union.
Mr. President, what do you see as the long-range intentions of the Soviet Union? Do you think, for instance, the Kremlin is bent on world domination that might lead to a continuation of the Cold War? Or do you think that under other circumstances, détente is possible?
Well, so far, détente's been a one-way street, and the Soviet Union is used to pursue its own aims. I don't have to think of an answer as to what I think their intentions are. They have repeated it. I know of no leader of the Soviet Union since the revolution, and including the present leadership, that has not more than once repeated in the various communist congresses they hold their determination that their goal must be the promotion of world revolution and a one world socialist or communist state, whichever word you want to use. Now, as long as they do that, and as long as they at the same time have openly and publicly declared that the only morality they recognize is what will further their cause, meaning they reserve unto themselves the right to commit any crime, to lie, to cheat, in order to attain that, and that is moral, not immoral. And we operate on a different set of standards. I think when you do business with them, even in a detente, you keep that in mind.
Now, Dinesh D'Souza reported about this, or wrote about this, this first press conference in his book, Ronald Reagan. This is a book from back in the late 1990s. And he said that when Reagan said that about the Soviet Union and how that they were determined to bring about a world revolution and to build up a communist world, and that they'd do whatever they could to further their cause, including to commit any crime or to lie or to cheat, that there were those in that press room that audibly gasped. And the president's own Secretary of State was standing over in the corner rolling his eyes. And he was one of the more hawkish in the room. The liberal left, of course, they thought, well, hey, we need to appease them. We need to do everything that we can to come to the negotiating table. We need to work toward detente. But as Reagan brought out, detente's been a one-way street. We come and we want to reduce the number of nukes in the world. Well, okay. But we can't very well do that or commit to doing that when the Soviet Union is expanding its arsenal. And this is the truth of the matter. They will commit any crime, they will lie, and they will cheat. D'Souza brings out in his book that the reporting the next day after that press conference, it just reinforced in the liberal left that, boy, we've got a president now who's just a simple-minded ideologue. That's all that he is. What a reckless cowboy. What a simpleton, this man. Well, he left that press conference. He was walking back to the White House with his national security advisor, Richard Allen, who followed behind. And according to D'Souza, Reagan beckoned to him, and Allen jogged to catch up with the president. Yes, sir, as Allen recounted the story to me, Reagan asked him, isn't it true that communism gives the Soviets the right to lie? Allen replied, I believe it is. Reagan continued, and don't we know for a fact that the Soviets steal and cheat? Allen answered, they do, sir. And Reagan permitted himself to chuckle. I thought so. He knew the press was mocking him. He knew all of the doves would mock him. But he took the Soviets at their word. And he said in that exchange, you don't have to get the answer from me. Their secretary generals repeat it from ever since I can remember. And he took them at their word. And he said, this is what they've said. This is what they want. And so we've got to aim for peace through strength. We've got to be strong. We can't just be satisfied to contain the Soviet Union. We've got to push back. And he did. The United States did. And what happened to the Soviet Union? Well, there might have been other forces at play, but there's a reason. When Reagan visited Eastern Europe later on in the story, after his presidency, after the wall came down, after the Soviet Union collapsed, there's a reason that they cheered him. There's a reason that they had posters in their homes of Ronald Reagan. What a difference. Peace through strength. That new booklet I mentioned at thetrumpet.com, great again. You can go to The Trumpet and run a search and find it. My father introduces the booklet by saying, do you believe the United States of America has been mainly a positive force in the world for most of its history? Do you believe that? Ronald Reagan did. You can see it in that exchange. You can hear it. Look, we are a force for good. We have a different standard of morality. These other ones, the evil empire, as he would famously call them in 1983, they'll commit any crime, they'll lie, they'll cheat. And isn't that what we've seen? Isn't that what we've seen, Secretary Security Advisor Richard Allen? Well, yes, sir, it is. I thought so. Who's made to be the fool now? So much criticism and flack from the left and the right. Peace through strength. My father says here, do you believe the United States of America has been mainly a positive force? Obviously, it hasn't been a perfect nation. No one would suggest that, but mainly a positive force in the world for most of its history? Do you have a favorable view of the founding fathers, the Constitution, separation of powers, rule of law, manifest destiny, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, free market economy, America's role in World Wars I and II, and Pax Americana? If you do, my father says, if you do, then surely you are deeply alarmed by the state of America today. Surely you must be alarmed. Because for all the lies and the deceit and the cheating coming out from some of America's enemies, like Iran, you have officials in the United States government working overtime to cover that up. To not take them at their word, to ignore the fact that they repeatedly say, yes, we're going to build a bomb. Yes, we're going to destroy Israel. Yes, we're coming after the great Satan. All of that's ignored. And meanwhile, to sell the deal, to sell the deal, or to get the hostages back, who is it that's out there lying now and cheating and willing even to commit crimes? Says a lot about where we are today, just 30-some years on. My father says, all of these pillars of American history and identity are being vilified and destroyed. America's educators are teaching oncoming generations to be embarrassed by them. Even the nation's leaders see them as shameful. On many foundational issues, they share the views of America's worst enemies. That's the truth. Read this new booklet online. Great again. You know, Donald Trump's out there saying, make America great again. It's not going to work out, even if he is elected as president. You know what he said yesterday in a speech? There's one thing you can be sure of. I'll tell you the truth. Really? Haven't we heard this before? I'll be as truthful, as honest, and as transparent as, well, like no other administration. And then the lies, the nonstop lies, and the laughter, and the bragging, and the boasting. My father says the nation's foreign policy is utterly transformed. We've seen apologies, concessions, and surrenders made to dictators and despots, while long-time alliances like those with the United Kingdom and the Jewish State of Israel have been cast aside. Nations that have relied on America for leadership, strength, security, protection, all of this. It's no longer there, is it? Perhaps you're also concerned about the rapid erosion of many other mainstays of society. He talks about personal accountability, civility, respect, racial equality. The pillars of American society, they're breaking down. He says, yet many people, including the nation's highest leaders, are encouraging and celebrating these radical changes rather than fighting them. As I write, we're approaching the end of the second term of President Barack Obama. Many people recognize that his presidency has been destructive to the United States. The booklet you're reading explains why and how. So go and look at that booklet. It's a collection of some pretty recent and very powerful articles that we've quoted from often on this program. I'm glad they've been organized and put together in booklet form. It says here, finally, there's a spiritual dimension to America's decline that most people do not see. That's the thing. That we have to see the spiritual dimension. Again, it goes back to Revelation 12, 2 Corinthians 4, 2 Corinthians 6, John 8. My father says, the crisis facing this nation is not because of a bad president. The cause is far deeper. But most people are unwilling to face it. Will you face it? Have you faced up to it? Look at what's happening. Look at how fast and dramatic these tragic changes have taken place just over the course of a generation or so. It's pretty amazing. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to send us those emails. Send them to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States. One in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Yesterday I told you that when we moved to England 19 months ago, one of my personal goals was to become more cultured, to become a more cultured individual. I mentioned how that I wanted to study more into British history and visit as many of the sites as I have time for while traveling about here in the UK or in Ireland or into the Netherlands or France. And we've seen, as I said yesterday, quite a few of those sites and have learned a lot along the way. We've seen a few Shakespeare plays live, and a couple of the operas, as I played for you yesterday. I mentioned this lecture that Ryan Malone gave a couple of months ago about the throne room of God and how that we're here to develop that throne room culture. You can read about it in Revelation 5, all of this beauty and splendor, this music and singing and this worship of God revolving around His throne, this angelic choir singing blessing and honor and glory and power be unto Him that sits upon the throne and unto the Lamb forever and ever. What an impact that vision should have on our thinking. I was covering in class this morning that section in Acts chapter 7 where Stephen is about to be stoned, the deacon Stephen, who was filled with the Holy Spirit and who looked up to heaven as he was about to be murdered and he saw Jesus Christ standing next to the throne of God. And he was overwhelmed by this vision. And even prayed that God would have mercy on his persecutors, his killers, that God would forgive them. What an impact that throne room had on that saint, the deacon Stephen. Well, that's the culture, that throne room, that God wants for his people to spread. And of course, it needs to spread into our own individual lives first. And so, to follow on what I finished with yesterday, how can you go about changing your cultural tastes? How can you become a more cultured individual? There is a way, and it's really not that complicated. The first step to take in changing your cultural tastes is to make the decision that you are going to change your cultural tastes. Make the decision that you're going to become more cultured. A couple of verses at the start of Colossians 3, read them. It says, if you're risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sits at the right hand of God. Seek the throne room culture, in other words. Set your mind on those things that are above. Think of Matthew 6 and verse 33, memory verse. Seek after the kingdom of God. Seek after God's righteousness. You've got to make a decision to do it. Verse 2 says, this is Colossians 3, set your affection on things above, not on the things of the earth. And so if it's of God, if it's of a godly culture, if it's something God appreciates and enjoys, if it's something God created, then set your affection. The margin in the King James says mind. Set your mind on those things. Set your mind on the things above. You've got to direct your mind to godly things, to the throne room of God. It starts with a decision. The second step that you can take, and I alluded to this yesterday on the show, but the second step to take is to do the research. Do the research. It doesn't have to be appreciating opera necessarily. It could be a number of other things. But do the research. If it happens to be opera or appreciating classical music or getting into the ballet, or fine arts, the more you can study into it, the more you'll appreciate it. Now, half of those things that I listed off yesterday that I've either visited or viewed or heard or what, I'd say about half of them I actually did put in some time and, you know, going to Blenheim Palace, let's say, as compared to Warwick Castle. I didn't do much with respect to Warwick Castle, but with Blenheim Palace, it was a little bit different. Churchill had spent a lot of time there, so I read up on it. I wanted to know as I went in there, okay, this is what happened there 60, 70, 80 years ago. And it made it more enjoyable, the visit. It made it more educational. Warwick Castle, on the other hand, I mean, I enjoyed the day with the family. And some of the exhibits certainly were educational, but I just kind of went in blind, so it wasn't... It didn't have that kind of an impact on me. And the same is true with the opera, as I was saying yesterday. If you know that you're going to go, study up a little bit on the story, even if the story's not the greatest in the world, you at least know, you know, what's happening from scene to scene. And then get the music ahead of time, listen to it, find out which ones are the most popular, find out a little bit about the performers, find out a little bit about the composer, find out a little bit about the venue. In the case of these two that I've seen, the State Opera House in Vienna and then the Royal Opera House in London. I mean, that alone makes it worth going to almost. I mean, there are things now in this modern age that are performed on those stages that I'm sure would not be appropriate at all. But you get the point. Do the research. Spiritually speaking, Paul said to Timothy, study to show yourself approved to God. Be a good workman. Be a good workman. Rightly dividing the word of truth. Yesterday we referred to that verse in Hebrews about your senses being exercised. I mean, put in some time to prepare for a culturally uplifting experience. If you just go in blind and you have these preconceived notions that, oh, well, this is classical and I'm not going to enjoy it, you'll probably just go in and snooze your way right through. If you study, that may well not happen. You may be wide awake and alert. You may be, as in the case of that experience I had at the State Opera House in Vienna, you may be blown away, and the impact of it may stay with you. The third point, or step, that you can take is to force yourself to stay with it all the way through to the end. So what if you do get sleepy? So what if you are bored? So what if it is something that's just, well, it's not your cup of tea, as they say? Force your way to stay with it all the way through to the end. Now that, as I alluded to a few weeks back, that was something our music director was forced to do as a teenager, Ryan Malone, 13 years of age. And this was just in watching it on TV. PBS was showing this four-part opera series by Wagner. And his mother forced him to watch it. That's quite a commitment. They had to, at that time, they had to record some of it because it was such a long opera. And while he came to find out later that it wasn't actually the best opera in the world, he was impressed, even as a 13-year-old, of just the size and the scope of this effort. And he came away from it thinking that, well, I think I like opera. And then as he wrote to me yesterday, he sent me this email. He said, then I went to see one live at the Met in New York. And it's like when you think you like something, but you haven't really known it in its full glory. And I realized that no one would actually dislike opera. I mean, not if they were able to experience it like I experienced it. He said, if people only hear the music, it doesn't make as much sense. If they see it, they're seeing it more in its true form, visual and audio. But if they experience it live, with the sounds bouncing off the walls into their ears, within the same room, this is how it was intended to be consumed. Composers weren't thinking about televised performances or audio albums when they first started writing these. They were thinking about this big production, like what we saw in Vienna, like what we saw in London. Now, you may be thinking, well, that's great, but I'm, 5,000 miles away from those cities. Well, if you're around Edmond, Oklahoma, as Mr. Malone brought out in that email yesterday, these magnificent musicals that this church sponsors and puts on display at Armstrong Auditorium, they're not that far removed from these great operas of old. It's the same with Broadway musicals. That's perhaps the more modern day format of the opera. And a lot of college productions can put on these shows in local communities. So it's something to definitely keep your eyes open for. If it's just before a TV, though, even as it was for Mr. Malone back as a 13-year-old, there's some benefit there to forcing yourself to stay with it all the way through to the end. Let me just leave you with this goal. I gave this to the campers last weekend before they left PYC, as we put quite an emphasis over the course of that camp on becoming more refined, on becoming a more cultured individual. And one of the goals that I gave to them, I told them to put this in their notebook, to put this in their journal, and that is to bring God's beauty and culture into your life every single day. Bring it into your life every day, even if it's for a few minutes, even if it's fine music for just a few minutes, or going outside to appreciate the beauty of a flower bed. Or you could go right down the list to gaze at a painting. Just for a few minutes, start with this. Bring God's beauty and culture into your life every single day. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we put the finishing touches on yet another week of broadcasting here on KPCG.FM. Send those emails to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week. We'll see you next week.